You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Talk to us about where we are relative to winning the peace. Is it going to be a longer-term event than we would like it to be, but simply that's the nature of the beast when we're trying to engineer such a fundamental change in that part of the world?
It's going to take longer, Mac, than the timelines that this White House has put on it, frankly. And I've been public on this issue. I think that the numbers that we have dedicated to the process are too few, and the timeline for our withdrawal is too short. And I've called on the administration, and I've called on others to reexamine both of those. And this is not the last you'll hear of me on this subject. You know, we went from a Japan that was flat on its back at the end of World War II to today having the third strongest economy on the planet. We went from a Korea that was flat on its back at the end of the Korean War to having the 9th or 10th most effective economy on the planet, a very effective democracy, as is Japan's democracy. The same with Germany. You know, Germany is an economic and political powerhouse. And none of those things occurred because we did, in the aftermath of war, 5 years of a limited presence and then pulled out. I almost can't imagine where we would be today if that had been the driving operational thinking at the time. You know, I commanded roughly 150,000 troops, spending between $8 and $9 billion a month. And for us to go from that size force to something less than 10,000 and do it for only 5 years and expect that with an active insurgency that has no intention of coming to the table, and Pakistan, which appears to have no intention of being helpful in the peace process, nor to reduce its safe havens, which have given sanctuary to the Taliban now for years, with virtually none of those things really changed, except that we certainly pushed the Taliban back as we were building the Afghan security forces out. Our departure, just as it did in Iraq, is going to create a risk, a level of risk, and we have to recognize that. So my concerns are that our numbers are too few and our drawdown timeline is too quick, but there's no bad time to make the right decision, and my hope would be that we can get this under control relatively soon, and the new administration, I don't want to get into the politics, but the new administration will take the time to do a comprehensive assessment of the relationship, the inextricable relationship of the political health of the nation with its economic progress, with the security situation, because they're all inextricably linked. They're all tied together, to take the time to do the kind of assessment necessary to determine, in the aftermath of several years of post-conflict international support, whether we're on track or not. Because if we just maintain this drawdown schedule and numbers, I think we're creating for ourselves the same kind of challenge that we now have to address a second time in Iraq. We have, for all intents and purposes, been successful in the conflict, but these conflicts don't end when the guns fall silent, so to speak. These conflicts end many years or even sometimes decades later, and it requires a constant touch of some form or another. But you can't just say, and you just can't isolate the security dimension of what you're doing from the economic dimension of what you're doing and from the governance as well. You simply can't isolate them. They're all inextricably linked. So when you pull down our security presence, it also then forces the embassy to pull back its capability of touching key Afghan leaders who, now feeling exposed, because there's the security presence and the security calculus has changed, and feeling neglected because there's no American political touch, it creates a sense, as you pointed out correctly, that there will be a willingness to accommodate the enemy. And when that occurs, since the enemy has never been about economic progress or any kind of economic situation that we would recognize, then the economy begins to flag and money starts to flee. So they're all inextricably linked. And my position would be, please stop the drawdown right now. That doesn't mean we haven't been successful. That doesn't mean we failed. That doesn't mean that the intent to draw down was bad. But let's stop for now, because the Taliban are not willing to make peace. We just killed Mullah Mansour, who needed killing, because we thought he might be a partner for peace. It turned out to be even worse. So he needed to go away. We now have the emergence of something called the Wilayat Khorasan, which is a province of the ISIL caliphate, which has emerged in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it is a further complication to the security situation. It's time for us to stop the drawdown and take a moment and a deep breath, because the next president is going to end up owning the outcome in Afghanistan. Let's let her or him take the time, having stopped the drawdown, having frozen everything in place, let's let her or him do a detailed assessment of the state of the governance, the state of the economy, in the context of the state of the security, because they're all inextricably linked. And if we don't take a big step backwards and a strong, thorough investigation of this, we're liable to find ourselves once again re-employing troops back into Afghanistan, and now, just as we are in Iraq, in an emergency situation. You asked me about ISIL first. Let me take a huge step back and tell you that unless we, as a community of nations in the West, are willing to approach the issue of the radicalization of hundreds of thousands of young Muslims around the world, and this is not about being a Muslim, it's about conditions that lead to mass hopelessness and the radicalization in the sense of fury that their parent governments have no capacity to care for them, no intention to care for them, and no potential to care for them, unless we as a community of nations are willing to undertake an endeavor as big as the Marshall Plan, a generational approach, we are going to be facing an issue of mass radicalization and extremist organizations, violent extremist organizations like ISIL, for generations. And we have to grip this, because the solution, Mac, cannot be frozen conflict. The solution cannot be permanent war. And your sons are already young officers in the Marine Corps. I've got a grandson who likely will serve in the Corps. And I don't want to see your sons fight extremist organizations, because we haven't done anything to resolve the underlying circumstances. And I don't want to see my grandson and probably his grandson fight. But that's where we're headed. If we don't get a grip on these underlying social, economic, and political issues that radicalize hundreds of thousands of young men and women who desperately just want prospects. That's the first issue. That's what's causing so many of these problems in the Middle East and the broader North African, Middle East, South Asian regions. And it's really the cause for the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. It wasn't about faith. To some extent, there was that component within it. But it primarily was about large segments of the population, what's often called the youth bulge, of kids who had no hope. And they turned on their governments, and one after another they went down. Tunisia went down, Libya went down, Egypt went down twice, Yemen's gone down, Iraq's nearly gone down. Many of the other states in the Gulf were violently assailed by civil unrest, and of course the great poster child of how bad this can be, a region with failed governments and engaged in civil war, is Syria. Syria is the ultimate example of how bad this can be. And unless we try to get, as I said, to the underlying circumstances, we're going to find more of these examples. And it's going to be a real problem for us. So with that as context, these violent extremist organizations, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Abu Sayyaf, Jamaat Islamiya, all of these organizations typically have many of the same characteristics. And in the case of ISIL, it was, in fact, a component of Al-Qaeda, and we fought them. We fought them in Iraq. In fact, we killed the leader of that organization, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was a mad dog, in my mind. And we didn't get his deputy, and his deputy today is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, also known as Khalif Ibrahim, the leader of the so-called caliphate, And so the organization, Mac, is a symptom of something bigger, something darker, something that has yet to be resolved by the people in the region because of their limited capacity, and is yet to be fully embraced by the community of nations as, in many respects, the kind of existential threat that the Soviets were to the West many years ago. So ISIL is a symptom of something worse. We're engaged now in dealing with it, but in dealing with ISIL, it can't be the end state of our effort. It has to be a waypoint in the larger, probably generationally oriented effort that we have to undertake.
Just another preliminary, as Iran and Saudi Arabia do this dance, and until they can, as nations, as peoples, until they can accept the joint responsibility to work together, to accept each other's presence, nothing productive happens. And we can fake it. We can fence them off. You know, we can go there and we can keep the lid on it. But until Saudi Arabia and Iran somehow or other accept each other's presence, I don't, how does this work, sir?
Well, it hasn't obviously for a very long time. And, you know, it's a really perceptive question on your part. When I talk to people who are trying to understand the region, one of the first things I tell them is, in your analysis, as you seek to understand the region, as you seek to react to events that are unfolding before you, if one of the first considerations that you have isn't what I call the Cold War between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the revolutionary Islamic regime in Tehran, if that isn't one of your earliest considerations as to why something is happening in the region, you're probably going to miss the reality in your analysis. So that's the first thing. Now, why is there competition? It's only partly religion, and maybe isn't mostly religion, or the confession that one worships Shia for the Iranians and Sunni for the Saudis. I would contend that it's really much bigger than that. It is competition politically. It's hegemonic competition to dominate as much of the influence in the region as possible. It's economic competition in the context of the oil enterprise. And then in there somewhere is the inherent friction that comes from a violent Shia revolutionary regime bumping up against a fundamentalist Sunni Wahhabi-oriented system of faith in the kingdom. And all of that makes for what would appear to be frozen conflict. So, you know, the recent comments came out of Washington of something to the effect of, why don't you guys just figure out how to arrange the neighborhood and share the neighborhood? That couldn't have gone down more difficultly in the region, because those guys aren't interested in sharing anything, and they're not gonna. And the Iranian effort to have a nuclear weapon has spurred the Saudis, and King Abdullah, before he passed away, Saudi Arabia said to me twice that Saudi Arabia will never end up number two in a nuclear arms race. These are big stakes here in the region. And unless the United States is part of the process to keep the lid on it, this could go badly. And the complete collapse of Yemen is probably one of the examples of what happens when we aren't involved in the process and the Saudis undertake a military coalition to defeat the Houthis, who they believe and probably are supported by the Iranians. And it's very much a Cold War environment at several different levels, and it makes stability in the region, in the Gulf, but more broadly in the region, it makes finding stability and ensuring stability pretty difficult.
With that as a backdrop, what is the way ahead for the United States and the coalition that you essentially crafted? What is the way ahead for the United States and its coalition in the fight against ISIL?
Well, we're gaining traction now. you know, as I said to leaders in Washington, you can't take on an organization that looks like a juggernaut. You can't take it on frontally, as we did, in a moment of really grave emergency in the late summer of 14, and expect to have immediate results. And so what we did was we chose to take this organization on in roughly five different ways. The first was the military way, which is the most obvious. Gets a lot of the attention, but it isn't in the end where the decision will be determined. So we have the military activity going on, and there's a lot of purchase occurring. We've taken back a lot of the ground, liberated a lot of the population. Cities that you knew and I knew have either been liberated or being liberated. We're fighting in Fallujah even as you and I speak right now.
Roger.
Another area is the area of the finances. The finances provide the capacity for the organization to operate. And we've really begun to shrink the finances by attacking the oil enterprise, shrinking the capacity of the banking system to provide the platform for economic solvency. We've gone after their leaders. We're attacking their cash repositories. They had quite a large amount of cash that they took out of the banks. Gone after those. We're shrinking their financial assets. We've begun the process in a comprehensive way of reducing the flow of foreign fighters. They have been reduced substantially from the beginning. We're attacking their narrative, going after them in an information conflict, and then we're stabilizing the population. But all of that doesn't happen overnight. It took us a year to get organized, a year to assemble the resources, and in the second year of the campaign, the tide has turned against the enemy. But as I've told everyone all along, you know, we can't find ourselves at the end of the 3 or 4 years it's going to take us to defeat Daesh, lift our heads up and say, oh, good, now we're finished. Because we're not finished, because they're just as Daesh is a lineal descendant of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda is a lineal descendant of other extremist organizations, if we don't get after, as I said previously, if we don't get after the underlying reasons why the people of that region are radicalized and forced into the arms of these violent extremists, if we don't get after that, we are going to fight son of Daesh and grandson of Daesh, and it's going to go for a long time.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.